Coming up on this episode of The Social Hour, Amber and I are going to speak with Dave Delaney. He's the author of New Business Networking and a real social media expert. All that and more next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for The Social Hour is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is The Social Hour with Sarah Lane and Amber MacArthur, episode 177, recorded Thursday, August 28th, 2014. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another fun-filled episode of The Social Hour. I always say that. It's because it's always fun. In Petaluma, California, where the Twit World headquarters are, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm Amber MacArthur. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And I don't know, Sarah, there's so much social media news this week. It was hard to get stuff into the rundown. We had to get rid of a lot.
Yeah, it's true. In fact, I started on our little, when I stack the lineup, so to speak, yesterday, and I was like, "Huh, how are we going to do all of this?" So I think we've cherry picked a pretty good show, pretty good hour. And I noticed that your background is a little bit different. We're actually. You're next to yourself.
I am trying to step it up every single week on the video version of The Social Hour. So, yeah, you know what? I'm obsessed with this little arm I have here that holds the iPad. And I decided to put a picture of this is actually the podcast screenshot for the audio version. So just mixing it up. And it looks a lot better because it's nice and bright and blue. And I don't know, Sarah. I'm playing.
I love it.
I'm tinkering.
I love it. It's great. Well, we've got a good show. And in fact, we're going to start off with a guest that Amber, as always, has found who is. Now, Amber, I don't know if you want to set this up. How do you know our guest?
Sure. So I don't know if Leo introduced me to Dave years ago, but I've known Dave Delaney for quite some time now. Originally, I knew him through working at Griffin Technology. I used to work with him. He would send lots of cool products my way. He then went off and started his own business. He does lots of stuff in the social marketing space and beyond. And he sent me a message last week and he said he'd love to come on the show. And here he is.
Dave Delaney, author of New Business Networking and speaker, technologist, very pervasive on the internet. Welcome to The Social Hour.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. So what's new in your world? What's big in your social world this week?
In my social world this week? Well, let me think. I've been playing with an app, actually, that I love that's not that new. I don't know how new it is, but it's called Mosaic. Uh-huh. Have you guys played with this?
Yeah,
it's an
yeah.
Instagram app that actually, you might have covered it before. Excuse me if you have. But it's really cool. It you can pull 20 of your favorite photos together and you can produce a book from it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I've actually made a Mosaic book in the past.
Oh,
yeah, just to kind of see how they were. And I thought that the quality was really good. I was really happy with it, actually.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with it. So I've been playing with that. That's one new little thing that I've been playing with.
Always fun stuff coming out. Now, one of the things that we were chatting on Twitter about back and forth is just this idea of new business networking. And I know that you've written a book on this topic. You had lots to say based on our interview last week with Scott Stratton, where we were getting into the conversation around networking through social media and how, in some ways, it's kind of lost that sort of special feeling that perhaps it once had, particularly around Twitter and conversations happening there. So we'd love to first just get your view on our conversation last week with Scott and what you kind of think is happening today when it comes to new business networking.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, when it comes to Twitter, for example, there's a lot more noise out there now, a lot more. So it's harder to cut through the clutter and actually meet people and make connections. And that's why, Twitter doesn't always, I love Twitter, for sure. But the problem with Twitter is they don't do a great job promoting some of the benefits that they have, for example, advanced search, where you can actually search and find people based on hashtags or topics, or using a third-party service like Moz has followerwonk.com, where you can actually search Twitter bios and find people that actually have similar interests or work in similar spaces or industries as you do. And that's a great way to connect with people. And then the advantage of using Twitter lists, something that every time I speak at a conference and I mention Twitter lists, most people are not using them, and it shocks me that people aren't. So it's a perfect way to like add groups and things like that. So Yeah, I think networking on Twitter is still, you know, it's still there, you know, otherwise it would just be all advertisements all the time. And so luckily it's not that. We're able to still have great relationships and conversations and such. But I think it is a little more challenging now to keep track of that. And for new users, certainly to find, you know, great people to connect with. And a lot of brands and people get on Twitter, the first thing they do is try to sell things or, you know, and in that case, they're just kind of doing it wrong. And I always use Twitter. I use the analogy with Twitter, which has been used a million times, that it's like a cocktail party or like a networking event, and that you wouldn't go up to people at a networking event or a cocktail party and just interrupt them and try to sell them something. Right. Well, you got to behave the same way on Twitter. Right. You got to listen to what people are talking about and then, you know, respond, ask some more questions, maybe chime in with an anecdote of your own, and then, you know, build relationships over time. So,
you know, Dave, one of your more recent blog posts was about proper use of hashtags and improper use of hashtags. And you made these points that there are certain networks on Twitter, for example, hashtags sort of help make Twitter go around. And then on something like LinkedIn, people sort of try to use them, but they don't really work the same way. Facebook is, I don't know, somewhere in between. When you speak at conferences, and I know that there are obviously different levels of people who are just getting started in social media or are experts themselves, why do you think that some of these, you know, syntax like a hashtag is so difficult to grasp?
I think it's a lot of monkey see, monkey do in a way. I think people see them being used and then just start using them without really understanding why. And I think that's in my own consultancy and what I work with my clients. Most of my clients are already using social media that oftentimes they're not satisfied with the results because they've just sort of set up an account on everything and they're trying to do something everywhere or the same thing everywhere. And I help, you know, shed a light to, you know, how they maybe should be doing it or do it differently. With hashtags, though, I think people just misunderstand them. And I think that's it. I think it's just, you know, poor use of hashtags. I mean, even using like a common word, like, I don't know, banana, you know, unfortunately, a million different people are going to be using that hashtag. So using a really custom hashtag for something like an event, or if it's a banana, then it's, you know, Dave's August banana hashtag or whatever, it, you know, something like that, whatever it is, that's something that you can actually track. So, but I think, I think it's a lot of people that just jump on the bandwagon and just start using hashtags without really understanding why they're even using it in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just looking at our Twitter feed, and I have to say you have a lot of friends on Twitter because a lot of people watching you live, so which is a testament to the fact that you definitely know how to build relationships. One of the things I had emailed you about as well that we wanted to chat about was this news from Twitter where they were chatting about this new program they have called Flight School, which is for agencies. The idea being that Twitter now makes it possible if you're an agency, if you need to train people on how to use Twitter in a more effective way, they're really building up that side of their business. I mean, this is probably based, as they mentioned in this article on Ad Age, that Twitter netted $277 million in advertising revenue during their second quarter of this year. So we know it's big business for them. Do you think this is something where it's worthwhile for agencies to do this? Have you looked into it at all?
I've looked into it a little bit more out of curiosity about this story because it's pretty new. And I can see where it's relevant. I can certainly see where it's going to you know, like when I consult clients about, say, blogging, for example, they don't have things to blog about. They don't know what to write about. I tell them to look at, to talk to their customer service department and find the most, you know, the frequently asked questions and write blog posts about those questions. And then you can lead people that are confused or whatever to those questions, to those blog posts to get the answers they're looking for. And in a way, this is sort of similar. What they're doing, what Twitter are doing, is creating, you know, comprehensive videos that are almost like an online school, basically a flight school, if you will, that will walk agency people through how to use Twitter most effectively. And so it makes sense that way. I'd like to see them do something like this, even for new users, just, you know, rather than just agencies. But I'd love to see them do some sort of, you know, instruction into how to use things like Twitter lists, like that I mentioned before. And speaking of hashtags, they're using Take Flight as the hashtag. And I searched it earlier just out of curiosity. And like, you, there's a million different things people are using Take Flight for. So I don't know why they didn't use like Twitter Take Flight or some other hashtag so that they could actually track it.
You know, Amber and I have actually had a problem with the social hour because, you know, at some point we were like, okay, it's going to be hashtag the social hour if you want to ask us questions, that sort of thing. But it's enough of a common term that it's hard to search. And you know, and then it sort of became like, should it be Twit social hour? And that nobody's going to remember that. And it's not a perfect science for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you guys have been doing this so long now that, you know, early on you could use a term like social hour and, you know, people weren't using hashtags like they are now. So it made a lot of sense that way. But yeah, unfortunately, yeah, when you use common terms like that, you can kind of lose following the conversation. So yeah, I think flight school is pretty interesting, and I think agencies will gain a lot from it for sure.
I'm just curious, though, you know, running a small agency myself and dealing with agency people all the time, I wonder, are there things that you just can't teach people on Twitter? And what I mean by that is I see agencies make mistakes all the time, not just agencies, but individuals who don't understand that Twitter isn't all about selling, that if you want to sell something, you better hope that you have 5 or 6 tweets beforehand that aren't just about pushing out some product.
A lot of agencies are misusing Twitter. And I think that the purpose of this is to get them up to snuff and to understand better how to use it. But I see your point in the fact, and what the analogy I used before of the cocktail party is, you know, a lot of brands are getting onto Twitter and just trying to sell stuff. And I see agencies doing a good job, especially for huge brands, but for smaller, medium sized businesses, I really think that it should be, you know, the head of PR or the owner of the company, CEO, whatever, they should be the face of the Twitter account. And they should be the ones that are building relationships that way, you know.
One last question for you, Dave, before we let you go. Where do you see from the brand side, I guess, social networking? You know, we've got big players like Twitter, like Facebook. Sometimes regular people complain that brands muck the whole experience up and that, you know, once a company goes public, it's all about money. Do you see the landscape different than it is now in, let's say, 6 months to a year?
That's a great question, Sarah. I think it's interesting where things are going right now. I mean, I understand these companies need to make money. I mean, that's a given. But the problem is that the more our timelines are cluttered and filled with advertisements, the less likely people are going to, more people are going to leave and less people are going to join. So it's very important that if it remains, you know, that social networks mix in some form of revenue stream. Absolutely. But I think right now a lot of people are going away. Like I'm having a lot of great conversations with close friends using Path and just using a private account or it's private anyway, but using a Path account. So that kind of gets us off of some of the other places that tend to be a tad noisy. So I don't know, but I think it's a big conundrum for the social network businesses because, yeah, if we see too many advertisements, then people are just going to go away over time.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Dave. It was great to connect with you. It's been quite a few years I've just been chatting with you online, and it's been so nice to have you on the show. And good luck with everything that you do. We'll put a link to all your stuff in the show notes on our website for the Social Hour.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dave Delaney, author of New Business Networking. He's at Dave Delaney on Twitter. DaveDelaney.com is where you can find a lot more from him. He's got a blog and all sorts of good stuff. He pretty much lives on the internet. So he's our kind of people, Amber.
Yes.
Quick reminder before we get into some of our news of the week that we do record this show live on Thursdays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, right after Know How for anybody who likes to watch our live feed. Of course, if you can't or prefer to watch us on demand, that's okay too. twit.tv/TSH is the website to go to. That's where all of our show archives live, where when we say our show notes with links, guest links, story links, all that good stuff are on all of our episode pages and subscription links to subscribe to the show and get it automatically downloaded each week as well. So thanks to everybody who participates, no matter how you decide to watch or listen to us. And as Amber mentioned at the beginning of the show, we have audio versions too, because I know some of you guys like to drive and listen.
Or run.
or anything else. So that's good. I mean, you know, who wouldn't want to watch us? But hey, you're busy people. We understand. All right, so what's our first story of the news?
I just thought this was kind of interesting. This is a bit of Facebook news. So Facebook has announced that they've turned on bandwidth targeting. This is an article from TechCrunch, and the idea being that it will match mobile ads to your network quality. Based on this article, what they're saying is as Facebook evolves in other countries where people use primarily mobile phones, they're going to have to deal with the issue that not everybody is able to watch videos in terms of ads on their phones. And so they'll be testing this out, and they'll serve you up the type of ad based on the bandwidth that you have at that moment. I'm kind of surprised they didn't already do this. I mean, it seems like such an obvious thing, but I think it's also a really smart move for them. And I think from a user perspective, it will then lead to a better experience too.
Yeah, I thought this story was interesting as well, especially because the majority of Facebook users are outside, the U.S., right? But the U.S. is still where most of the advertising revenue is coming from. I think the U.S. and the U.K. is really, really the bulk of where Facebook's making all of its money. And it's doing really well. But clearly, growth is slowing down in the U.S. and the U.K. and some more established markets. Markets where people are primarily accessing Facebook on mobile, or maybe that's the only way that they've ever accessed Facebook. Speeds aren't necessarily all going to be the same. So it does make sense that the company is like, all right, well, we definitely want to figure out how to make money in those growth areas, but not bog down the system and make it as seamless as possible. It's really smart on Facebook's part.
It's really smart, and obviously more options for advertisers and, like I said, a better user experience. Another interesting article, and I'm sure you've talked about this already because it's big news coming out from Instagram about their new Hyperlapse app.
Yeah, so Hyperlapse is a standalone app from the folks at Instagram. I actually talked about it on i5 yesterday, and it's interesting because, Amber, I don't know how much you've been on Instagram the last couple of days, but it is not a feature that has been built into Instagram. It's a whole different app. And curiously, the day that it launched, I had a really hard time finding it in the App Store. I don't know if anyone else had that issue. You type in Hyperlapse and nothing comes up. So I had to get a direct link somewhere else. The idea is what is even the word I'm looking for?
Time lapse.
Yeah, exactly. I keep wanting to say hyperloop. I really have a problem with the word hyperlapse. It's time lapse app. It's very easy to use. But the team at Instagram has made a lot of emphasis around how they have their own in-house image stabilization that they've been working on. And that makes the time lapse videos much more compelling, because if they didn't have this kind of smoothing quality to them, they wouldn't look so cinematic. Instagram keeps using that term, cinematic. And what's great, and this is speaking of a great link to peruse on your own time, the engineering team over at Instagram has this great blog post that explains in detail exactly what image stabilization means and how they built it specifically for this app. And it's really fascinating. In fact, I did some tests, Amber, the other day to try to see, all right, well, how well does it work? One of my time lapses was I was holding the phone and really not even trying to keep it steady while I was eating breakfast. And, you know, it wasn't a very steady experience. And, you know, it's not as if the phone isn't moving at all, but it was pretty smooth. So it's interesting how the company, because of course Instagram is kind of still about those still photos, even though they have video capabilities now, that they decided to spin off another app that does something completely different, but the team has been, you know, working on the technology under the hood.
Yeah, and I mean, traditionally, if you want to do a time-lapse video, obviously you have to spend a lot of time to do that. There's more investment. Traditionally, you would lock off the camera and you can't really have that movement, or else it would be shaky. So I think it's really interesting, particularly from an engineering standpoint. And I know that's what a lot of people online are talking about, because they do have that stabilization element. I mean, just in the videos that they show off, and we'll put a link to those in our show notes, just the fact that they are able to get those videos to be so consistently stable, I mean, it's phenomenal to see what they've been able to do with that. So I'm excited to try it out. I know they're getting a lot of attention around this, and I'm sure people are going to love it. You know, more creativity online, we can all use that.
My Instagram feed, which is, again, it's a standalone app, but Hyperlapse encourages you to share to Facebook or Instagram, or Vimeo is the other option. It's kind of full of Hyperlapses right now, and I think when the novelty wears off a little bit, people will, you know, they won't be jumping the gun so much just to have a Hyperlapse to share. They'll probably figure out what's a really good one and then share every once in a while. What do you think about, I know that people seem to be increasingly really divided on the idea of these apps that, instead of making Instagram more feature rich, the team said, you know, this is an app that should not be part of Instagram. It should be its own thing. You have to download another app. It's another icon on, you know, your iPhone, for example. I know Molly Wood, for example, is just like, I am sick of this whole standalone app thing. You know, I don't want Facebook Messenger to be separate from Facebook. I don't want Instagram to force me to download another app. You've got Path Messenger is another example of the team saying, it's just sort of a different experience. I don't think I really have a problem with this, but why do you think it bothers people so much?
Well, I mean, I don't know what the article was exactly, but I do remember us talking about something that said the average person uses about 8 apps a day on a regular basis. So I think it becomes an issue that people can kind of only manage a certain amount of apps on a daily basis. And so when you have to start downloading new ones, then, you know, it just becomes too much and too overwhelming. I don't mind the standalone apps really all that much. I mean, I think that it helps me just clarify what exactly I'm using those for. But I tend to download a lot of apps, and then a lot of them I will get rid of relatively quickly. So I think it becomes an issue for the developers, really, at the end of the day. I mean, how do you develop loyalty to those apps? And in some ways, you've got to build up entirely new communities. I mean, Instagram has this great community, and now Hyperlapse, you know, kind of has to start from scratch in some ways, even though obviously you can share them on Instagram. So I think it has challenges on both sides.
Yeah, I definitely see where it is easier to say, oh, you know, we've been working on this other thing, and instead of trying to make it sort of seamless and cohesive, we'll just give you another product, and then you can download it if you want to. I know that Facebook particularly is kind of a fan of that sort of approach, just see what sticks. Obviously, Instagram is owned by Facebook, so is Hyperlapse, really. But it's, you know, it's interesting nonetheless. It's nice to have another fun toy to play with, and it is a really nice app. It works really well.
And you have to wonder, too, from an advertising standpoint, if that gives some of these companies more inventory to be able to sell against, right? You know, Facebook can sell against Instagram in terms of advertisements, and they have more places to sell. I mean, it reminds me like of a TV network. Like, the more content and more inventory they have, the better chance they have to sell different packages to different sponsors. So maybe that's part of their strategy. Who knows?
Who knows? What we do know is that Pinterest happens to be testing a news section. Amber, how in the world would that work?
So this is a really simple thing. So I mean, thinking the word news is somewhat misleading here. The idea is really you're just able to see updates from people on Pinterest. So it's working only now on the iOS version, and people will start to see a little a news section in the notifications tab, and then you'll get a sense of what people are pinning and some of their updates. So I think it's interesting. I mean, Pinterest as an app becomes more interesting all the time, and it just seems like they're following suit, and I think a lot of people will like this. As we know, Pinterest users are some of the happiest social networks around.
That's right.
Around, right?
Yeah. And we've even sort of tried to figure that out. Why is it? Is it because it's so visual?
Why are they so happy?
And yeah, I think it's sort of a combination of people like pictures of cool stuff. In general, Pinterest it's aspirational, right? It's either, oh, I wish my garden looked like this, or I'm going to buy a new couch. Here are some of the coolest couches that I've seen online. I'm talking specifically about my own Pinterest experience. I'm always using the couch as an example, but yeah, Pinterest seems like it has expanded so much in its reach, and at the same time been really smart about it. Nothing that we've seen from Pinterest, I feel like, which includes Pinterest messaging, seems off the mark or sort of like a Me Too type of a thing. And it's, you know, I think that's why it's been so successful.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it does feel like they also have the ideal audience. We know these are happy users. We know these are people who are coming there and sharing and doing things like home decor, planning weddings, whatever it might be. So at the end of the day, I mean, there's huge value for Pinterest in ensuring that that audience is as content as possible when it comes to pushing out advertisements as well. So yeah, I'm always impressed to see what they're doing. And I don't think, unlike some of the other social networks, they've really had any major screw-ups when it comes to privacy or user design. I mean, there's not a lot of Pinterest backlash that I see online.
No, no. I think the other day I mentioned Pinterest to somebody and I got kind of an eye roll and I said, why don't you like Pinterest? And he was like, I just don't use it. So yeah. I was like, okay, now that's not fair. I mean, if you don't like it, that's one thing. But if you choose not to use a social network, it's like, you know, and you don't have a great reason. Yeah, I think it was just sort of that typical, like, oh, that's all I hear about is Pinterest type of a thing. But no, hard to dislike it, really, if you're actually on the social network.
Don't be a hater.
Don't be a Pinterest hater. Unless you have a really good reason, and if so, we would love to hear it because all of your feedback is appreciated. Not everybody feels the same way about social networks. So thesocialhour@twit.tv would be the place to let us know why Pinterest is the worst. Moving on, this is a great little social tip, and this is something that has been available to certain brands and verified users on Twitter for a couple of months now, and that is personal analytics on everything that you tweet. So if you go to analytics.twitter.com, every Twitter user at this point, and I'm not really sure why they didn't roll it out to everybody at the beginning, can now see statistics on what they've tweeted. For example, you know, how many people actually saw that tweet. You know, tweets are, if you really want to get granular about your widest reach, and a lot of people have done a lot of studies on this, it's certain times of day, depending on what country you're tweeting from or where most of your followers reside. You know, if I'm going to tweet something at 3 a.m. Pacific time and most of my followers are local to me, well, nobody's really up, right? And how many other people will have tweeted from the East Coast and pushed down my tweet, and it just never will have been seen. All of that matters, and I think we all know that. But Twitter's actual analytics tool give you a much better sense of, oh, okay, who actually engaged with me? Hmm. You know, who clicked on that link that I embedded? Because quite honestly, I've always found that those numbers are sort of depressingly low. You know, you think, oh, I've got 80,000 followers, and I'm sharing this link, like, half of them will click on it, right? No. I mean, you're lucky if like 1% of them click on anything. Because again, as Dave was saying earlier in the show, it's a kind of a noisy experience, especially because we're all following more people and these tools become feature rich. And it's just kind of a good, I think, reminder of how things are working behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun to dive into it, right? If you do spend so much time on Twitter, I had fun just kind of diving in, seeing what was working, what wasn't working. I've started to use Vine a little bit more over the past week. I met a friend who is pretty active on Vine, and I was amazed to see the reach of those Vines compared to some of the other tweets that I would send out on Twitter. So it's fun to just get a sense of what's working and what's not. I think sometimes, though, when we're talking about this idea of reach, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, many times it feels like those numbers are still a little bit inflated. Like these social networking companies want to make us all feel good. It's like stepping on the scale and they shave, you know, 10 pounds off. It still feels a little bit to me like they're embellishing those numbers somewhat.
Yeah, exactly. That's the funny thing about, you know, knowledge is power, but at the same time, sometimes it's like, it's a little, it's sort of depressing. And I think that these analytics tools that were available to brands and verified users, I don't really know why verified users got access to this, maybe just because they figured, well, you know, you have more followers, that kind of thing. But when brands want to use a tool like Twitter or Facebook or whatever and see numbers that are lower than expected or anticipated or that sort of thing, I always wonder, long term, what does this mean for the social network? Because eventually, you know, if this is where money is flowing in and out of, you know, do you put your faith in social networks that don't deliver the kind of numbers that you're used to getting, you know, with traditional banner ads or television commercials or, you know, the sort of stuff that doesn't necessarily work that well either, but that is more established?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's this whole space has a lot of maturing to do. So I think that's what's kind of exciting about it at the same time. Now, Sarah, for our spotlight of the week, I have something, and I thought about you when I came across this.
Oh,
and I'm hoping
that,
that you love it.
Me too.
I don't know if you've seen it. Have you seen it yet?
No.
Okay, it's called Serendipity, and it basically is a little cool service, like a visualization program that's been put out from Spotify. So it will show you when two people in the world click on a song at the exact same time or listen to the same song at the same time, and they have little dots all over the map. It's a fun one.
I love this. This is so... Now, who clicked Stars Are Blind by Paris Hilton at the same time? Good
grief. People.
Two people, both in the U.S. of all places. This is so cool.
It's really
fun. I love it. Yeah, because with so many people, obviously, Spotify has a very large reach as far as streaming music goes. There is, you know, a high likelihood that in any given second... I might listen to. I'm not actually using Spotify on a regular basis, but this is so interesting.
It's
I
fun.
Love it. I
and
love
they,
it.
They play a little snippet of the song. So I just sat there literally and watched it for quite a few minutes because you can discover new songs because they are playing a little snippet of the music. But it's just fun. I mean, it takes their data and allows you to visualize it in a really interesting and innovative way. And I mean, I think this is the future of big data for a lot of these companies, you know, just doing stuff with it like this that puts it in a different context.
Yeah, I most of those songs and artists I'm familiar with, not all of them, though. So, yeah, It's not only sort of this like, ooh, regionally things are different. People listen to different things, but oh, interesting. That person in Sri Lanka and I both liked that Maroon 5 song at the exact same moment. That's great. I love Serendipity. I hadn't seen it before.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
Good stuff. We'll have the link in our show notes as well if you want to play with it. And thank you for thinking of me, Amber. I really appreciate it.
I try, Sarah.
Okay, so we got an email from Norm who lives up in Seattle. Who says, we're down in Seattle, if you're Amber. I would imagine that you high-profile women, he calls us, have had some experiences with trolls. Different subject dealing with these nitwits. Difficult subject, rather. But I think a segment of how to handle this online, with this online menace, might be very valuable. Now, Amber, I know that we don't necessarily need to get into our own, you know, on our own soapboxes about this. But I did think that this was actually an interesting lead-in to a social story that's really been bothering me this week. Are you familiar with Feminist Frequency?
I am now.
Yeah.
And I can understand why it would bother you.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to make this as short a version as possible just to get everybody else up to speed. I was introduced to Feminist Frequency, which is a YouTube web series, because the woman who is the main host of the series had done a video that was basically showing off how women in video games often not only are depicted in you know, misogynistic ways, but don't actually contribute to a storyline itself. So it's not only that it is, demeaning, but that it almost doesn't even need to be there, which makes it, all the worse. And the host started to get, like, really bad death threats via Twitter, to the point where the person had said some terrible things, including that he knew where she lived and knew where her parents lived and, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, she had to leave her home and get the police involved. And the whole thing just kind of, you know, I just thought, wow. I mean, I have my share of issues from people who are unkind online, but nothing quite like that. However, it could happen to anybody at any time. It doesn't have to be women, you know, abuse. And as Norm called it, you know, people who are trolling, that is that's just a very simple way to explain a concept that is really, really complicated and often really, really scary. And I honestly urge all of you to FemFreak, FemFreq, is her Twitter account. It's really, it's really interesting how she's sort of been dealing with this. And by the way, the videos are extremely good. You know, whether you're a gamer or not, she's really come from the right place, and she's got a lot of interesting things to say. But Amber, I guess what's your sort of overall sense of, is this just more of the same? You know, these people have to get reported and hopefully they get their accounts taken away from them, or does something else need to be done?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the most important thing is to obviously support people like this who are getting out there and who are talking openly and, reporting accounts if there are trolls. I mean, I was watching some of her videos, and I have to say I had almost like a sick feeling in my stomach because it just, it's so uncomfortable. And what makes me so sad about this, and this isn't a social thing, it isn't a tech thing, is the fact that there are grown men and women who are making these video games and putting them out there. And I don't know how you sleep at night. I mean, it's pretty horrible. So we'll put some links in our show notes, and hopefully we have some reaction from people next week. And, it's a horrible, horrible situation for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, as people who are in front of a camera, it is sometimes really, it's hard to deal with backlash or criticism or, that sort of thing. Kind of comes with the territory. And being a woman does sort of put you in a whole different category. However, nothing like this is ever acceptable. And I guess to sort of answer your question, Norm, because again, this could be a whole series. It is an increasing issue to deal with trolls. And as long as anonymity is possible, then I don't think we can eradicate this kind of behavior. And I don't know what the solution is, but that's why I don't like services and apps like Secret, for example, because I just feel like it is too tempting for somebody to anonymously attack another person or a group of people. And in general, it just makes us all feel horrible. So yeah. Who wants that?
Nobody.
Should we, we're almost to the end of our hour here. All right, so let me just remind you, because we just threw a bunch of sort of heavy stuff at you. If you have feedback on anything that we've talked about on the show, good and bad, of course, and whether or not you like Pinterest, do email us at thesocialhour@twit.tv. You can also leave us a voicemail. 2626-SOCIAL is our Google voicemail inbox. Had a few emails few voicemails this week that we couldn't play because you gave us your phone number. So don't do that. That would be really helpful if you don't do that, because we're not going to play that live, because that would disrupt your own privacy. So do call back with a question or a comment, because we love to play those on the show. Try to keep them to 30 seconds or less. Videos are fine as well. Upload it somewhere. Send us the link. Whatever you'd like to do. And thanks for your feedback in advance. All right, Amber, what about our rad or fed for the week before we wrap up this show?
Okay, so I kind of know the answer to this one, but I thought we should talk about it because people are talking about this particular little thing as a gadget, so it's worth talking about it in the rad or fad segment, and a lot about this in the news. It's called the Knee Defender, and as someone who flies a lot, I will say that I find this absolutely ridiculous, but nonetheless, apparently people use it. One person in particular who was on, I believe it was a United Airlines flight, and the flight had to turn around because there was so much disruption when this person was using the Knee Defender to defend themselves from a reclining airplane seat in front of them. So, what can I say, Sarah?
Now, this is a situation where I feel like I almost have to remove myself because I am pretty small. So, as much as I sure I like legroom as much as the next person. But it doesn't really bother me when somebody reclines, because then I can just recline, and then it's like, then we're still sort of equidistant type of a thing. But I have had people behind me say, can you not recline? I simply don't have any room. You're hurting me, that sort of thing. So there's sort of like this claustrophobic thing happening on airplanes all the time. And I've had this conversation with people who are, larger, longer legs or whatever. Jason Howell, who we work with, he's like 8 feet tall. I've seen him on an airplane. He's miserable the entire time. You can't actually recline into him. You will hurt him. But should we be basically hacking airplanes as well? Because it seems like it's just a surefire way to cause a fight, especially if somebody's had a couple cocktails.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, what I was even surprised about is the fact that the FAA had in fact said it was okay to use these when you were in flight. I mean, they have some specifics around the language there. I don't know if they've changed their stance on that. But, I mean, if you're really going to bring a gadget to stop a person from reclining the seat in front of them, maybe you just shouldn't fly somewhere. I don't know the answer. But it just seems like, hopefully at some point, people can just be polite to one another. And like you said, ask them, hey, please don't recline your seat. I don't have a lot of room. And maybe people will just listen. That would be nice.
It wouldn't. Yeah. The airplane etiquette is the weirdest, isn't it? You know, you've got the people who want to chat with you and you want to sleep, or the people who are in the aisle seat and then they want to sleep and you're like, but I just drank a lot of water and I'm going to have to get up three times. It's like there's so many ways to upset your neighbor while on a not comfortable, cramped, not very cushioned seat where you possibly don't have leg room. I mean, I don't think that this is the solution. No, because then it's like you're just sort of that person who's like, no, I've decided that I am more powerful than everybody else on this plane. So I am going to tell you what to do rather than have some sort of a friendly discussion about what our options are. Maybe you could switch places. You know, the tall person can go in front and then everybody can recline. And everybody's happy.
Just figure it out. Yeah. It always amazes me, even when I get onto flights and there'll be a mom traveling with her kid and for some reason they're separated and she'll ask someone to change seats with her and people won't do it. I feel like, you're right. Airplane etiquette is probably, people are the least human in the air for some reason. And I think a lot of it has to do with airlines. I mean, I think they've taken the humanity away from the experience just because they pack us in there like sardines and more people, just the pressure of it all, like literally is getting to people. Hence the knee defender, which hopefully is a big fat fad and no one will ever buy it again.
I think it's a fad as well. In fact, I think if the FAA hasn't, taken it away from everybody, it won't be long until they do. Chat room, somebody in chat room says, if somebody in front of you reclines their seat too far back, just start giving them a shoulder massage. That's polite. I think that's a terrible idea. I mean, if it were me, hey, I might not need leg room, but I need to not be touched by strangers. That is 100%.
Sarah, you're so boring.
Yeah. It's like, just go ahead and give me a shoulder massage and then I will bite you. And then we've really got a problem.
Well, that's a whole other level.
Yeah, that's a
gadget.
Just the idea of being touched. Ugh, not on a plane. Not on my plane. All right, Amber, on that note, time to wrap up this edition of The Social Hour. Great guest, Dave Delaney, had a couple connection issues with him, so we'll be sure to book him again in the future because he's got a lot of great things to say about social. He's perfect for us. Good show this week. Amber, anything that you've got going on next week that the folks at home should know about?
Not too much. Kicking off September, lots of work going on, but just planning to book another guest for next week. I don't have anyone in mind. So if people have suggestions, please do let us know. You can let us know on Twitter or email us. We've had a phenomenal run, so we're going to keep that up.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks for watching and listening to The Social Hour, episode 177, everyone. Until next week, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm Amber MacArthur. We'll see you soon.